This is the Karima Brown Show. You are, of course, listening to 702. Now, the State Capture Commission was warned that there are fake social media accounts doing the rounds, including one purporting to belong to the former Bosasa Chief Operating Officer, Angelo Agrisi. All eyes have been on the former Bosasa CEO as he testified in front of the Zondo Commission of Inquiry. He's testifying there, wrapped up today. And he implicated former President Jacob Zuma, several organs of state, top government officials in corruption. He testified that Bosasa paid millions to officials and journalists to ensure that the company stayed afloat. Another example of this fake news phenomena was, of course, a statement alleged to be from a former journalist at The New Age and ANN7, Farida Joyce, which was circulated on social media and on WhatsApp. And it also, of course, turned out to be fake. And the other important fake news claim was that they tried to suggest that they were bankrolling the SABC 8, a group of journalists who blew the whistle on editorial interference at the public broadcaster. And they said they gave a donation of 100,000 rand to the campaign. And of course, this also turned out to be fake news. Well, joining me tonight to look at the efforts to insert fake news into the state capture narrative that are used to be to mislead South Africa, and also just the response from society in general. I'm joined in the studio by Tandi Smith. Tandi, good evening. Welcome to the program. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
And then on the line, she's obviously still at work, is the head of policy, Tandeka Tubule. She's the SABC economics editor and part of the group of eight who also testified in Parliament. Tandeka, good evening. Welcome to the program.
Hi there, Karima.
Now, before I want to start talking to you guys about this phenomena, I just want to play you a clip from Sanef, from Sam Mkokele, who's the chairperson of the Media Freedom Subcommittee at Sanef. And of course, Sanef dismissed and made sure that the apparent, injection of cash from Bosasa into the SABC was completely fake. Let's just have a listen to Sam Mkokele quickly.
Look, I bothered myself today to verify if Bosasa made any donation to the SABC 8 through the crowdfunding. There is no truth at all to the report. There's no sign at all. I mean, I went through the names and then the amounts of people who donated anonymously and otherwise. Mm. And there is nothing at all that suggests that they may have. And as SANEF, we are totally, we have no bad business with Bosasa or any of their leaders, so we had no business dealing with them. So the allegations clearly just do not make sense at all. I mean, as you in your introduction explained, the politics around the events of the SABC 8. Mm. They were opposed to the bad analytical leadership at the SABC and people associated with Bosasa. It doesn't make sense at all that William Voko would lose his job by fighting so-called state capture and the rogue leadership at the SABC, and for him to be accepting money from a rogue Bosasa. It just doesn't make sense at all. So the allegations are completely unfounded.
That is, of course, Sam Mkokele from the Media Freedom Subcommittee at SANEF speaking about the attempt to try and embroil the SABC 8. Now, of course, this is not the first time that we see various political actors trying to discredit the SABC 8. And I want to start for a particular reason, because that's the public broadcaster. That is the one institution that the majority of people who watch television use to access news and information. Tandeka, you have had to go to court to, of course, get your information declassified and refute the claims that you were part of Stratcom as alleged by the EFF through the video of Winnie Madikizela-Mandela, the late Winnie Madikizela-Mandela. What do you think is behind the effort to try and constantly chip away at your integrity, your commitment, and of course your fight against the manipulation of news for narrow interests, particularly at the public broadcaster?
Well, Karima, I'm just going to speak as one of the eight of us, and I'm just speaking in my personal capacity and not as an employee of the SABC.
Yeah.
But a public broadcaster globally, universally, is supposed to be one of those main institutions that form the ballast of organizations or institutions in the press or in the fourth estate.
Yeah.
It's supposed to be one of the main, or if not the main, watchdogs of democracy.
Mm.
So the whole thing about fake news is that it is designed to discredit and spread misinformation and manipulate the political environment for narrow political interests. So the main aim is to discredit the truth tellers and to have them down, so that in the war for information and the war for people's minds and hearts, only the bad guys win. And the bad guys are relentless. But we are on to them. And we have noticed certain things. Karima, the factories for the bots are back.
Mm.
The Bell Pottinger like strategies are back.
Mm.
The factories for manufacturing fake news are back. That means that we need to warn, as the democracy watchdogs, we need to warn South African citizens that these things tend to happen towards elections, and they happen in a number of countries. It's the same cycle in a number of countries. We also need to, particularly today, warn South Africans that in multicultural and multiracial societies, one of the things that fake news does is to try to polarize by using emotive, racialized language.
Yes.
So, for example, today we're supposed to focus on not so much the corruption that was done by a web and a myriad of people who are accountable to us and who've taken our taxpayers. We're supposed to focus on the racism of one man.
Absolutely.
Right. Right. I'm not saying that it's unimportant that he is a self-confessed racist, which is really bad, but you must remember that trolling is one of the tactics of fake news generators. And trolling is about starting a quarrel or upsetting people online to distract or sow seeds of discord by posting inflammatory and digressive content that is off topic.
Mm.
And the aim is to normalize tangential discussions and create those as the norm, rather than to focus on the real damning and devastating social issue of the day, which is malignant and rampant corruption that has stolen the future of our kids.
Absolutely. Tandeka, we're going to be speaking now with Tandi Smith. Tandi, Tandeka makes some interesting points that I want to pick up with you. The one is, of course, the fact that the campaign to discredit the fact that there was actually a state within a state built. There was a political project to hijack the constitutional democracy, that the campaign to discredit that is actually back. It's morphed into a different form. Even though Bell Pottinger is no longer around, you have crasser efforts to get that kind of information back into the mainstream. And it looks as if the state capture beneficiaries, the looters, have almost come together to work out another media strategy. Do you agree with that? And if so, what points us in that direction?
Yeah. Good evening, Tandeka, as well. You know, Exactly. The points that have been made are absolutely accurate. You know, I think we are seeing a sort of second wave of, you know, you could almost call it a Bill Pottinger 2.0 yes. type of situation. But, you know, what's interesting to add and to just think about is that discrediting journalists, the pushback against the journalists who uncover these issues, who are grappling with the powerful institutions, they have always been pushed back on and opposed by the powerful. In whatever way or form that happens, we deal with the safety of journalists across the continent. We see, you know, getting into horrifying situations, even worse than we've seen recently. So it's the issue of clamping down on journalists when they are in these positions isn't something new. It's the methods we're seeing. And, mm-hmm. you know, MMA as an organization has been doing quite a lot of work around this. And to sort of summarize also what Tandeka has been saying, you know, we see trends happening mm. around this mm. and we sort of have shaped it as your six D's of undermining democracy.
Okay.
And you know, I can elaborate on these points, but you have instances of deflecting,
yes,
disinforming, discrediting, dehumanizing, deploying the trolls, mm-hmm. as Tandeka touched on, and destroying democracy.
Mm.
And you see this sort of pattern repeating itself. And yes. now with the issues that we're seeing around the state capture narrative, we're seeing elements of all of these playing out.
Tandeka Tandi has summed it up really nicely with that 6-3 or that 6 D's about deflecting, destroying, you know, and disinforming. What worries me is when we first uncaptured uncovered state capture, and you will remember while you and I were involved in shedding light on the the betrayal of the promise report by the academics, which actually concretely looked at in a granular way the way in which Gupta-led state capture worked. There was a lot of outrage from society. There was a lot of people who came out and spoke. But this time around, when, for example, it was just casually mentioned that Bosasa had contributed 100,000 to the SABC 8 campaign and that they paid off journalists, there was like a deafening silence from society. And that's, of course, always worrying. Why do you find that silent? What do you ascribe it to, Tandeka? Is it fatigue? Is it the fact that people just can't process the information? Is it that we are not focusing on the right issues? Why is there a lackluster reaction to the deliberate distortion of the truth by people who have looted the state of hundreds of billions of rands?
Okay, in the critique that I'm going to offer of why we haven't responded in with leadership excellence in our profession is I'm including myself and criticizing myself as well. We need to be more structured mm. and more analytical in our understanding of what is going on. And we need to make the comparisons with other countries. For example, one of the things that fake news really does do well is to polarize society.
Mm.
And people become so diffused and so scared and so emotionally polarized. Like, for example, let me give you an example that's away from home so that people can relate to it more easily. In Myanmar, mm. the whole Rohingya thing was started also with, they had a problem with fake news
mm-hmm.
and a problem with racial and ethnic polarization.
Yes.
And when the bad guys in that society decided to flood social messages and social media with that kind of ethnic and racial baiting, it's resulted in real polarization in not only online, but in real life.
Mm.
And you know, that thing is so dangerous because it's not only corrosive to democracy, but it can lead to the loss of livelihoods and also ethnic cleansing, which are crimes against humanity. So people haven't yet really seen just how serious what we are dealing with is. So I asked the president in Davos last week what we plan to do, because countries like Germany have banned hate speech online, and they hold media conglomerates like Twitter and Facebook commercially accountable for any breaches of German law on these matters. And France is moving towards the banning of fake news, and there are a slew throughout the world of legislative responses. So for us, this is still an unfolding area in which we can innovate legislatively while harmonizing with the spirit of our constitution, which guarantees in 16(1)(a) freedom of expression, freedom. So we really need to sit down and analyze, study this, think it through, and really plan carefully how to protect both the democracy and the freedoms won through so gallant a struggle against apartheid.
Absolutely. You know, whilst you were talking, Tandi was nodding her head vigorously. I'm guessing in agreement. Tandi, come in here. What Tandeka is pointing out to actual practical examples of a legislative framework that actually outlaws this. I mean, we haven't even begun to talk about that kind of thing.
Mm. You know, I think the whole regulatory framework and looking at it as at a policy perspective is a whole other conversation you can get in for hours. But what I did want to add on to that, your question in the beginning was, you know, around why is our response been so, you know, kind of just sitting back and just accepting it.
Yes.
And for me, it speaks more to the fact that the public don't know who to turn to for credible, accurate information.
Yes.
We are in an era where public media consuming audience is struggling to discern real from rubbish information. And I think that really impacts how people then respond to these claims, because I think it also has to do with fatigue. We've spent the last few years with explosive stories coming out. We're going into inquiry after inquiry.
Mm.
And also now leading up to elections, you know, we are a politically obsessed nation.
Yes. Yeah.
And as damning as the evidence is and as outrageous as it is, you can almost understand that the having so many different narratives at play at one time is disconcerting for the audience.
Absolutely.
And you sort of don't know who to turn to. And it's the reason that media have to be doing so much more to build their own credibility and trust.
Absolutely. Tandeka, I want to bring you in here because you've been speaking about the fact that we need to have proper leadership, that we are too disparate and that we are too divided within our own ranks to respond to this in a rational, cognitive and coherent manner. So, for example, the kind of interviews with Sanef and so on, it's just like, you know, just another kind of interview. There isn't actual real leadership that's coming from the industry itself. I mean, you had a situation where you had to literally go to the state security and get information declassified, which indicated that you were not an apartheid spy and that, in fact, Stratcom was spying on you. You went to court. You took a political party to court. They owe you R1 million. They've just walked away. There's been no consequences for them on that. I have had a threat made to me by a member of the EFF. The police tried to prevent me from actually laying a charge. Now that I've laid the charge, all that they've done, all that they've been able to tell me is that the person who sent me the message did it from a prepaid phone. But even though I identified the person has never even been visited interviewed, questioned, or anything. What is it that we need to do to actually hold people to account? I mean, surely all political parties must be required from the IEC to commit to us doing our jobs without being, you know, intimidated, harassed, insulted, defamed, and physically abused, as has been the case in some instances.
We ourselves must become worthy of the title of democracy defenders. You know, Karima, the EFF don't owe me R1 million yet. We are waiting for the court to make some kind of ruling in the future about that. But let me say this about the fatigue. We cannot afford the fatigue. We can ill afford the lethargy. Today was a terrible day for the press because here were people in our ranks being outed for taking brown envelopes, for taking bribes. And I believe that each of us should call on, through our organizations and so on, call on the editors to hold those people accountable in the newsrooms through our press codes, through our Labor Relations Act, and expunge those people from our newsrooms. Those people who are guilty of such need to go.
Yes.
And then the honorable journalists need to stand up and put the record straight, because there wouldn't be a state of capture commission if it weren't for the journalists who found servers and unearthed a web of illicit and corrupt and depraved relations, commercial relations and other kinds of relations. There would not be a Busasa story today if it weren't for Adrian and Karin, who really worked hard on the story.
Yeah.
And many other stories that tell us the state we're in as a people and a country. Now, we need to reclaim the ethics of the founding fathers of this and mothers of this profession. And we need to send people in to the State Capture Commission to share what we know and recommit publicly to our values. And on the fake news stuff, we need to help our society to determine what is chaff and rubbish and what is the truth. And never has this battle for the truth been more important.
Mm.
I'm not just saying that because it's important now in South Africa as we head towards an election in a few months' time. But, I mean, you look at the U.S. election, the last election, and you just wonder what happened.
Yeah.
And then you look at the effects of fake news throughout the world, and you can see that some democracies are stolen. So, look, we need to tell our people that they must look out for impersonation, those fake accounts. They must look out for emotional exploitation, especially of the ethnic or racial kind. They must look at anything on the social media that tries to polarize and hyper-targeting of either individuals or messaging. Like today, the message was, he's a racist, he's done.
Yeah.
Meaning, his testimony should not be rigorously examined for the facts within it.
Absolutely. Tandeka, we're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to be also inviting our listeners to give their views on how they see the media, because Tandi raised an important point that people actually don't know who to trust. And the number to dial, 011-883-0702.
Karima Brown, taking your calls on 011-883-0702.
It's 15 minutes to 10 o'clock. This is the Karima Brown Show. I'm in conversation with Tandeka Kubule and Tandi Smith. They are both media professionals and people watching the media. And we're talking about the phenomena of fake news and the effect that it has on eroding democracies. And we're reflecting on what is happening in South Africa as the Zondo Commission of Inquiry comes through, and as there are increasing attempts to try and ensnare the media in this, and we're looking at whether the media has the leadership, the cogency, and the vision to actually stand up for itself, to make representations at the Commission, but also to come up with ways in which South Africans are able to tell a truth from a lie. Now, some of you have been sending your thoughts in. One is here from a guy called Fana. It says, "Hi, I'm Fana from Johannesburg. As a normal citizen of this country, it's frustrating for us to witness what's happening in the state. Corruption is being exposed by various people, but nothing is being done. And it seems like the culprits will always get away with the wrong doing." And then another person says, "Fake news has been around for a long time." And he quotes some French philosopher whose name I really cannot pronounce, saying, "False opinions are like false money, struck first by all by guilty men and thereafter circulated by honest people who perpetuate the crime without knowing what they are doing." So people are, of course, also talking. We've got some callers on the line as well. Let me go to Mr. Edward. I think it's Edward from Braamfontein. Edward, good evening. Welcome to the program. What question do you have for my panel?
Good evening, Karima. That's an interesting discussion tonight.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I was on TV with Mahasi Mahasi just yesterday.
Mm.
The whole narrative of, you know, the media industry is a sacred, it's a sacred institution.
Mm.
And there are high expectations from the general public, from the population, because we rely on the media to safeguard our democracy, to safeguard our economic governance. But then when we have some rotten eggs within the media industry itself, it's a worrisome development. But the idea of clamping down on journalists is a half-truth. Karima, you must understand that we come from a very difficult history where we have a skewed economy, which is still being monopolized by a few people. And if your humanity, if your share of humanity has been monopolized by a few people, we are definitely have to get into a situation where we have some journalists who would pander to the interests of those who control and own the economy. So you can see, Karima, that some of the journalists who have been singled out were the ones who defected to the other side, because this is a game of power. You must understand that Bosasa was getting out of hand. It was not playing by the rule book, and in so doing, actually approached some journalists within the media industry who accepted bribes to write good stories about Bosasa to cover under the carpet some of the malfeasance that was being perpetrated. So in this case, Karima, I quickly want to say that if your share of humanity has not been restored to you, we will still find ourselves in a situation where you will be tempted to accept a bribe.
Okay, Edward, you've made your point. We need to move on. There's some other callers. But before I take another call, I just want to get some comments from Tandeka and Tandi. Tandeka, let's start with you. The comment from Edward about the fact that we have a terribly unequal society and that people are looking for someone to blame. But that is that enough of a reason to say that we must almost live with fake news, if you like?
No, it's not enough of a reason, in my view. I think that the press and media organizations and the organizations representing journalists and editors really need to sit down and to sit and plot a way forward that that will guide not only younger journalists that come
through in the ranks, but also society, and really redeem us in the eyes of society. Because you, before we went to a break, you were speaking about this destruction of trust.
Yes.
Now, one of the problems in post-colonial societies is these rapacious elites. You know, mm-hmm. the elites that just maraud, they steal from the poor, and so on. The media has been able, in South Africa at least, to stand up to these people and to show a mirror to society about what exactly is happening. We need to really stand on our legacy and our history of being a good media and really take this further and really act in a way that's going to ensure the continuation of a good South African investigative independent press at this moment, because I think that's in peril.
Absolutely. We're going to go to a call, but before I do that, I just want to get Tandi's comments on what Edward was saying, because you were also nodding quite vigorously there. What do you make of the points that he made?
Quickly, just to say, the difficulty with dodgy news, misinformation, disinformation, is that they often have elements of truth. And in a country like ours, a lot of what we're seeing has elements of truth in it. And, you know, it's something that we need to deal with as society. It's not going to be, you know, what fixes it or you know, what moves us on. The difficulty with this is that there are elements of truth to it. That's why it makes it so difficult to discern what's real from rubbish.
Absolutely. Let's go to the lines. We've got Rutendo on the line from Randburg. Rutendo, thank you for your patience. What's the issue on your mind this evening?
Hi, Karima. I'm cringing as I'm listening to Tandi and Tandeka, because we live in a country where the media is owned by private stakeholders.
Mm-hmm.
And those private stakeholders are the very same private stakeholders that have ripped, basically raped and pillaged this country. And nobody seems to expose them. We talk about corruption as if corruption is the problem of South Africa. Yet this is the richest country by resources given to the world. The reason we do not have a sovereign fund is because of the very same Oppenheimers and the Ruperts who own the very same media, but we don't see them in state capture. We don't see the mention of their names in state capture, but they're the reasons why people are impoverished in South Africa. And the question is, why are they not part of the state capture? Nelson Mandela was living in a house bought by the Oppenheimers. But we don't talk about state capture. Appointments were being made that had to be approved by the Ruperts and the Roths. I mean, the Ruperts and the Oppenheimers. Even the finance minister was always appointed and approved by those people. We don't hear the talk of these people. Now, the question is, why do the Tandekas not talk and write about these people who have captured South Africa since it was apartheid South Africa and captured it even into independence, gave us the independence on terms that were suitable for the looters to continue to hold on to the wealth of this nation?
All right, Rotondo, I hear your point, and it's a point that's often made. I have a particular problem with your approach, because you're essentially saying that we need to take the moral equivalence of what apartheid colonial South Africa used to do, and we should say to ourselves that we can also do it because whites did it. As far as I'm concerned, I don't want to be guided by a morality that was determined as a crime against humanity. We actually need to forge a new path. We need to forge a new way. The media has always been privately owned, but the media, even in the hands of the state, has been captured for private political gain of, for example, the governing party. Tandi, you're shaking your head. Your response to Rutendo saying that we are essentially working for private institutions, that we don't write about their corruption, and they are actually the people who make the decisions behind the politicians.
It's a very controversial issue. You know, like you said, the issue of media ownership as a private institution comes up a lot in these conversations. And, you know, I think it is something that people talk about. But the minute you start talking about private media ownership, you start talking about corporate models. We built on a capitalist system. You know, that's what you're going to get. That's why it's so important that we have institutions like the public broadcaster. But as we've seen, just because they're not privately owned media doesn't mean that they're not at risk of being captured by other bodies.
Yeah. In fact, to such an extent that it is literally bankrupt. We had to have the state broadcaster, I mean, the public broadcaster explain today that there was a banking glitch. People were paid late. But it came against the background of the board warning that by March they will literally have run out of money to actually pay people. Now, how does that happen? That's got nothing to do with the Ruperts, nothing to do with the Rothschilds. That is, in fact, a public group, public broadcaster that has been captured for private political gains of one party. We're not even talking more than one party. We're talking about just the African National Congress. I mean, there's elements of the deep state in here that we need to examine. Tandeka, let me bring you in here. The allegation that we are in the service of those for whom we work and therefore we will never look at them critically. Is that a legitimate criticism against the way in which we go and deal with corruption? Because people seem to have a great deal of difficulty with dealing what they think is a selective approach to whom we expose.
In economics, there's this thing called regulatory capture. And an economist called Stiglitz that I became fascinated with around about 2012 or 2013 and wrote about extensively. I wrote about it with regards to the mining industry and the mineral energy complex at the center and the heart of our economy. Mm-hmm. Now, regulatory capture talks about private interests, commercial interests, that then bend the rules of the game illegally or legally to suit their profit-making projects. And we've seen a lot of regulatory capture in South Africa, both pre-apartheid and post-apartheid. We've got the kind of economy that lends itself towards monopolies in each of the industries. And once you've got too many monopolies, you have the tendency for them to buy the regulation and the policy frameworks that they like. So I don't think it's true that South African journalists have not raised the issues of regulatory capture, and I think that we should do it more. I like in particular the work of the journalists who exposed the long arm of the arms industry and its hold over current politics.
Yes.
Way back then when Arms Corps had an office on the Champs-Élysées underneath the South African embassy, and how the deals were done and how it affected things like the death of Chris Hani, the death of Anton Lubowski, and so on and so forth.
Yes.
So I think that South African journalists have dug deep there, and the person who wrote the book, I don't know why it's escaping my mind now, is really to be lauded. And we in particular here as the SABC 8, we've been shining the light on the influence of multi-choice on the SABC.
Okay, Tandeka, we're running out of time. I just want to give Tandeka a chance to get in there. The role of multi-choice in trying to capture the SABC is a big topic. Multi-choice is incredibly powerful. It has a monopoly in all things. Many of the people who used to work for multi-choice are now working for the SABC. How do you see this relationship, and what do you think of the way in which the regulatory authorities just allowed multi-choice to move in on the SABC?
You know, it is a very controversial issue at the moment, and there are all sorts of inquiries and regulations around how to deal with multi-choice and how to deal with subscription broadcasting and how to, you know, shape that to be better aligned with our broader goals and objectives. As you know, we had various court cases around this issue.
And a finding from the tribunal, the competition tribunal.
Yes, a finding. And that was on older contracts. I believe that there are new contracts between MultiChoice and SABC now, better contracts. But it is something that we have to be cognizant of, and we have to deal with.
Absolutely. This is, of course, a conversation that we can go on for a long time, and it's certainly something that we will return to. But, of course, we are guided by the clock. I want to say thank you to my guests and, of course, also the callers and my producers. What a fantastic show. A minute later than usual, but it's time for Eyewitness News.